You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 60 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin
Pelton. And I'm Tristan Caracino.
You're coming in too early on that.
Okay, do it again.
No, I think it's funny to do this.
I just get so excited.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we have with us for a special week, a special beer on the Peltoncast.
Yeah, I went to great lengths. I drove like 20 minutes each way just to get this beer. So I
a
hope it's
great
good.
Great lengths. I mean, all the way to get in your car and drive for 20 minutes.
Look, this is on a day where I wrote two trade grades in another entire column.
Well, not quite the same great lengths that people have had to go to make this beer possible.
I suppose that's true. Anyway, this is a timely indeed because it's the Fremont Pride Kolsch.
On this week's Pride edition of the Peltoncast.
I suppose it is. The description here, we are a family-owned craft brewery founded in 2009 to brew artisan beers made with the best local ingredients we can find. Pride, it's not just about the rainbows, unicorns, and glitter. It's about celebrating queerness and standing up for the safety and self-determination of the LGBTQ community. That you can't have those same vowel sounds back-to-back or consonant sounds. Really, it's...
you should tell them about the...
Yeah. Really, it's all... Well, I don't think they were intending for this to be read out loud. Really, it's all about love. Our goal with this beer is to create and foster a community for LGBTQ people and friends in the craft beer world. Be proud of who you are, who you like, and what you drink. The proceeds of this beer go to funding organizations supporting and fighting for the LGBTQ community in Seattle and the surrounding area. Here's to Pride. Here's to you. With love, the team at Fremont.
Well, but we're giving back with this beer.
Yes, very much.
And
so.
Also the Seattle sports community giving back with this beer.
Well, not this related week. To this beer. First, I wanted to pause to note, I don't know, do we like Kolsch's?
I don't even really know what a Kolsch is.
It's kind of Pilsner-ish, I guess. The bottle is really...
I'm just here for the can.
Yeah, it's really good looking here with the Fremont, what is that, a heron? Is that their symbol?
Yeah, that's a heron.
In the rainbow colors. So yeah, that's a good looking can right there. Is you are alluding to a press conference today where the five Seattle pro sports teams, the Mariners, Seahawks, Sounders, Storm, and Rain, came together to all announce their partnership with Athlete Ally, a national nonprofit supporting equality for LGBT athletes, and also named several ambassadors from the teams, Brad Evans and Chad Marshall from the Sounders, James Paxton from the Mariners, Sue Bird from the Storm, and Madeline Schiffel and Lauren Barnes from the Rain. Curiously, no Seahawks ambassadors. I don't know exactly what to make of that, but very cool to have all of the city's pro sports teams come together and come together for a good cause.
I was giving the Seahawks a pass because it's the off season.
Yeah, I mean, they just had OTAs last week. I assume someone must be in Seattle.
I would say that I think I'm pretty in on this Kolsch.
It's light, but a nice kick at the end there.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I think so. This is the second year they've done the Pride beer, correct?
That seems about right.
No, it's. I don't recall hearing about it last year.
Well, we weren't doing this podcast, so.
That's true. We were unaware of what was going on in beer because we
didn't know what was even happening in Seattle sports.
No. All a mystery to us.
Yeah, it's very flavorful. I don't know. I'm assuming a Kolsch is a German-style beer. Not going to look it up.
It is, yes.
But it's definitely very flavorful. Much like...
Well, I was going to say one other bit of sports activism news. The Storm announced last week that they are... supporting Planned Parenthood and will host a Stand with Planned Parenthood night on July 18th when they host Chicago in a game that'll be on ESPN2 and will donate $5 from each ticket and proceeds from an online auction.
Really? The Mariners are hosting Game of Thrones night. Are they? I think that was tonight.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, everyone has their niches in the sports community.
Anyway, I was saying that this beer is very flavorful, much like the burger that we had today. I'm so curious to hear what your thoughts are about this burger.
Okay, so part of the reason it was notable that I had to drive 20 minutes each way to go get this beer is that earlier I had tried to go out and meet you for dinner so that we could review our latest burger from Feed Company. And I got about halfway down to your office on I-5 in a traffic jam when you noted, as we were talking on the phone, oh, hey, Dwight Howard just got traded. And so I had to turn around and drive back home and write trade grades.
You have to blame it on your buddy Rich Cho.
I mean, congrats to Rich Cho for this deal. I toast to Rich Cho.
Wow. That's how good this trade was? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, Miles Plumlee was one of the worst contracts in the league. And it was, I think I may have graded them like a D minus for trading for Miles Plumlee at the trade deadline.
Who did they trade for him from?
From Milwaukee. They gave up Spencer Hawes, Seattle. Seattle legend.
It all comes back to Seattle. Really Rich Cho, Spencer Hawes here.
Spencer Hawes and Roy Hibbert in that trade for Plumlee. So that was taking on way more salary for the future. And now all of a sudden they flipped that into Dwight Howard. So that's pretty good for the Hornets.
Is Dwight Howard still any good?
He is limited. We'll see how comfortable he is with his limited role in the Charlotte offense. And I don't know exactly how Steve Clifford is going to figure out minutes, because I don't think he can really play Cody Zeller, who was their starting center last year and was quite good in that role, and Dwight Howard together at the same time. But what happened last year was anytime Cody Zeller went out of the lineup, they were terrible.
Really?
They were 3-17 in games that Cody Zeller did not play.
Wow.
And that single-handedly cost them making the playoffs.
I also did not expect to be saying wow about something Charlotte Hornets related.
Yeah, yeah, this podcast.
This is the only place to get free trade grades.
Well, no, I think there's some places out there if you look hard enough.
Also, these aren't free. You have to listen to us talk.
I mean, you know, that's priceless.
Anyway, I'm curious what you have to say about this Feed Company burger.
So you ended up picking it up, eating there, and then bringing mine to go to me and drive you at about 25 minutes, probably?
That seems about right.
Yeah, so it was a little chilly by the time I got it. It was not as
chilly. I went to great lengths to keep it warm.
What is that?
Well, I kept it in
you
the bag.
You have like a sun lamp?
In my car at all times. Lamp? Just for eating burgers. I have a whole atrium in there. Anyway, I kept it in the bag, naturally. I folded the bag, and then I put some stuff on top of it.
Oh, okay.
I put my jacket on top of it to see if that would keep it warm.
I don't know if that scientifically works, but I appreciate the hustle.
It was the best I could do.
So it was a little lukewarm by that point, but it was still a pretty good burger, and I could tell that if I had eaten it warm, it would have been a really good burger. What did you think?
I ate this burger with glee.
Glee? Wow, I think, yeah, you are higher on this than I was.
I would say that if we're going to have an Elite Eight of burgers, I would say of any of the new burgers that we've had, this is the one that I could see is most likely getting into that top eight.
So you would think ahead of, what's the Great State?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Ahead of Great State, for sure. Especially the whole package, right? Because the burger that we had, it's a very basic burger, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's your beef, cheese, lettuce, pickles, tomato, but we also added cheese and the star of the show here, which was perfectly cooked bacon.
Yeah, the bacon was really high quality.
The bacon pushed it over the top. It was by far the best bacon that we've had yet.
Now, you're much higher on bacon than I am.
It was just such a good bacon flavor. It was crunchy and smoky. It was excellent. Also, this is not a pricey burger. To me, the quality is as good as 8-ounce Burger Bar for half of the price.
I mean, to me, the quality is higher than 8-ounce Burger Bar, but you know that I'm not a fan.
The fries, there was not too much to them, but they were very good. I don't know what kind of oil they're cooked in, but I thought the oil tasted good, thought the tomato was good, the sauce was good, everything about it. They had dipping sauces that you could have gotten on the side.
Was the tomato a tour de force?
The tomato is not a tour de force.
The bar is not too high.
Honestly, it got a little bit mushy in there. I judge every tomato on the, is it a tour de force?
I mean, that's a good...
I'm not even joking. This is what I do.
Okay.
I'm like, is this tomato a tour de force? If not, then it's not anywhere near as good as In-N-Out, which, look, we're not even comparing it to In-N-Out. But eating this burger, every bite was excellent. I enjoyed every single bite of it. Is it the best burger in Seattle? Probably not. But it is a strong contender.
Strong contender. Wow. Strong words. I'm surprised that you haven't mentioned the special sauce here, which is, I had this written down. It's Quinn's special. It's Quinn's special sauce. Who's Quinn? Why? There's no information on their website about this.
Quinn, maybe the owner?
Maybe.
Look, shouts to Quinn, though.
Yeah, that's what Quinn makes is, a nice special sauce. It's got the right amount of kick to it.
They make a nice special sauce.
Oh, that's an excellent point.
But you could have gotten it on the side also. See, I thought about it. They had a list of the sauces you could have gotten on the side. I'm saying if we're eating there at the restaurant, I'm getting at least one sauce.
You're doubling down on special sauce.
And if I'm dipping in that special sauce, who knows? Could have pushed it over the top.
I thought the only downside here was the cheese was kind of meh. It was kind of like home-style cheese melting.
I agree with that. There were a couple bites where I was like, oh, that bite. Oh.
To me, it was like the last bite. There was just a little bit of char.
Mm-hmm.
That pushed it up 1 point.
Wow! One whole point!
From an 88 to an 89. That's my final score is 89. But yours seems like it's going to be much higher.
Well, I gave it a 90, so I don't know if it's that big of a difference. I mean, I think as time goes on, I'm judging these burgers a little bit more harshly. I would say that if you looked at the trend of the grades, I think they're probably much higher in the beginning than they are now.
Well, that's going to make it really hard for us to go back and grade these for the Elite Eight.
Well, we've eaten so many burgers, all of a sudden, I'm more of a judgmental burger eater at this point.
Your palate is refined?
I don't know if my palate is more refined, but after having all these burgers, I've kind of honed what I'm looking for.
It's funny for your palate to be refined. Do you have any thoughts on what burger we might do next week?
Well, what I really want to do, there are a couple options here. And I'm thinking that next week we should double up on burgers.
Okay.
And I think one of the options, maybe this won't work out, is doing the two West Seattle burgers that we have left, the Swinery and Coastline burgers.
Yes.
Or we can do the two taverns in Capitol Hill area that we have left. I guess one is more an Amazon area. And doing Brave Horse Tavern and Linda's.
Okay.
Would that make more sense for you?
I think that would make more sense. As we discovered while considering going to the two West Seattle locations today, the Swinery only serves burgers until 4 p.m., so it's really kind of a lunch-only thing.
Are they open after 4 p.m., but they don't serve burgers?
The butcher part of the store is open through 6.
Hmm.
Still not an after-work option. But I don't think they serve burgers inside.
Let's do the Brave Horse Tavern Linda's double up.
All right.
I want to do it. It's going to be nice in Seattle.
About to double up?
Yeah, I think it'll be great.
All right, well, if anyone is eating along, twice the burgers this week.
You've got a lot more work to do. You have double the work to do this week.
But
I want to just one last thing about Food Company.
Oh, okay.
Is I was going to say, judging it from the perspective of, there are a lot of different ways you can approach burgers, right?
I like to approach them to eat them. That's me. I don't know about you.
I approach them slowly. You never know what happens. By the
way, do you want to talk later about the burgers you cooked on the grill?
I don't know if I do. Okay. I guess somebody asked me what my special sauce was. So I will say that my special sauce, I just Googled what is Big Mac sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And it's French dressing is the primary ingredient in Big Mac sauce. Did you know that?
I assumed it was Thousand Island based.
Not Thousand Island, French dressing.
Okay.
So the sauce that I made, it was a pretty good approximation of Big Mac sauce, which is a pretty delicious sauce.
That's a top-notch sauce.
So I did French dressing, mayonnaise, a hint of sugar, and then relish. So I wanted chopped onions, but I didn't have an onion at the time. That would have made it pretty close to actual Big Mac sauce.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was good. The burger itself that I made, just not enough flavor.
Okay, the approaches to burgers.
If somebody were to ask me, I'm coming to Seattle, what burger should I eat? I would probably recommend this burger, especially if they're in the if they're in downtown Seattle, especially Capitol Hill. I think I would recommend this burger.
That's interesting. I had someone ask me for food recommendations on Twitter last week, and they were staying in the Fremont area, so I directed them to You Need a Burger.
Yeah, no, You Need a Burger is great also.
Yeah.
This feels a lot like You Need a Burger.
It'll be interesting to compare some of these head-to-head once we get into the Elite Eight.
I feel like this is the one that's closest to You Need a Burger style-wise of any of the other burgers we've had.
Hmm. I feel like the 206 Burger Company was the closest to You Need a to me.
Really? Maybe it's because I was in there. So you weren't in there, and it kind of felt like you're in You Need a Burger.
So it was really cramped?
No, there were not a ton of people there.
Okay.
Plenty of space. But it's on 23rd, right across from Uncle Ike's, kind of the new heart of Capitol Hill in the mm-hmm. Central District.
Well, speaking of things that came from that general area, some Macklemore news.
Yes, some Macklemore news. So we got this week.
Speaking of 23rd, I guess.
we got this week not only a new Macklemore song, but also we haven't talked Macklemore at all on this podcast.
I do not believe so.
But I would say that there was some general sentiment of disappointment about the last Macklemore and Ryan Lewis album, This Unruly Mess I Made.
I mean, I would say in fairness to Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, there was, like, long before that was released, everyone knew it was going to be disappointed. There was no conceivable way where it could not be disappointed.
Baby Fantasy Genius loves it.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
And did not remember, we listened to it all weekend. I've heard the song Brad Pitt's Cousin like 8 times in the last 48 hours.
See, the problem is, was he even alive for the heist?
He was alive for the heist.
Okay. But he wasn't old enough to remember it and to remember it getting overplayed so much. He never wanted to turn on the heist,
he hates it too.
That's funny.
It drives me crazy. Anyway, so because of some fatigue, we also got the news that Macklemore and Ryan Lewis not necessarily making music together at the moment.
That was a very delicate way of putting it.
I mean, well, I'll read the exact statement.
Okay.
Because I would say that the exact statement is a very delicate statement.
Yes.
And I'll parse it after.
Okay.
So this is the statement from Macklemore, which came out late last week. After the last tour, Ryan and I agreed that some creative space would be good for the both of us. Ryan Lewis is my brother forever. Kind of like you.
No. Is that what you're going to say when we split up to do separate Seattle sports podcasts?
Kevin Pelton is my brother forever. We've been working together damn near every day for 9 years, and it felt like the right time. This decision came from a place of love for one another. I'm the best man at his wedding next month. There will be more Macklemore and Ryan Lewis music to come when the time is right.
No, wait, is this the girl that Ryan Lewis, like, argued with at the Vera Gala a few years ago? Yes. Different one.
Same girl.
Do you actually know that?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's been with her since high school.
Oh, excellent.
Anyway, to parse this, I think that they reached a point, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis together, with the Heist album that nobody expected them to reach.
Yes.
They didn't expect it.
They exceeded their wildest dreams.
And I think after that, it's very difficult for artists to do the next thing, right? Because it didn't grow naturally. There are people, even the biggest stars, a lot of them grew very naturally, right? Or they were kind of in this mainstream world that has groomed them to reach this point. And then once they hit it, they're able to maintain it. Macklemore and Ryan Lewis were not really part of that world.
They were overnight successes.
They were overnight successes. That took like 10 years. You know, it's a weird thing to describe them, but the popularity happened very quickly. And they were also interlopers in the mainstream rap world.
Yeah.
Because they basically made what I would call like an indie rap album that all of a sudden people really took to.
That started winning Grammys.
Yes. And I think they felt really uncomfortable with it. And not only did they feel uncomfortable with it at the time, they also felt uncomfortable with it on the next record that they made. And I think they had a hard time figuring out exactly how they could follow up the Heist. And the follow-up ended up being pretty awkward, right?
Yes.
There are these moments where the big success songs, none of them worked, right? Downtown was supposed to be this big success mainstream radio song that basically got no radio play. Very minimal radio play. The song, like I was saying, Brad Pitt's Cousin, like Macklemore deserved a song, a celebratory song, just being like, look what I did. But it just didn't work. Nothing about it, except for a couple songs, really worked from that album. So I think there was some fatigue of them working together. The shows weren't going as well as they wanted it to. And basically when things drop off a level, something needs to change. And for Macklemore in the scenario, the thing that changed was kind of coming back to what he did at his roots, not with the Heist, but going all the way back to the language of my world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And working with a new producer, Budo, who produced that whole record, the Language of My World record, coming back and producing this new song that Macklemore put out last week, and it really feels to me like a return to form. This is the best Macklemore song since the Heist.
Interesting. I wish now that I had listened to it in preparation.
You haven't listened to it?
No.
How many trade grades have you been writing?
I was unaware that it was out. I just heard that he wasn't working with Ryan Lewis. That was the only part of it I heard.
You just, That's all you heard? You didn't read this NPR story? That's where people find out their news about Macklemore now.
Did that happen with the 2005 The Language of My World? Was that announced on NPR?
No.
Not even KUOW?
It was announced on KXP, its sister station.
Okay.
But it felt like Macklemore was recentering himself, right? They'd gotten out of what they do, right? And this song, the song Glorious, which I thought that you had heard and we'd be able to talk about, but clearly you haven't.
Nope.
This song felt like bringing Macklemore back to where he was at before all that success. Musically, it sounds very similar to the songs that came before. It's not trying to be too big. He's not trying to tell too much of a story, right? You don't know. just not
how
a lot.
How much credit do you feel like Ryan Lewis deserves for Macklemore's growth? Was it just a matter of timing, or do you think that his songs actually improved in quality?
He deserves credit, for sure.
Because, I mean, it feels like a lot of the success of the songs is often based on the beats.
The producer never gets as much credit as they deserve, though.
Of course.
But
in fact, Ryan Lewis, to be, you know, listed right there with Macklemore is the group, like, is getting more credit than most producers.
Yes. Ryan Lewis definitely deserves credit. But at the same time, I feel like Macklemore needed to come back to a place, to come back to his roots, right?
Uh-huh.
This isn't a song. There are many songs where he's dealing with these huge issues, right? Singles that came out, which most of the individual singles that Macklemore had released that weren't on This Unruly Mess I Made have been borderline unlistenable, right? I think there was a song that came out last year where Stereo Gum may have described it as the worst song ever recorded.
I mean, I do think you're underestimating the extent to which Macklemore was doing the same thing he was always doing, and it just was on such a different scale that it seemed different.
I don't think that's true.
I don't know.
And I think when you listen to the song, you'll hear that it's not true.
Okay.
And that's the thing about it, is you can hear in Macklemore, in the beat, that he's coming back to something that feels a little bit more comfortable, in a good way, right? It's not coming back into a rut. It's saying, okay, this is who I am. That record, we tried this, and it just didn't feel comfortable for anybody from the beginning. And I think that it took maybe separating himself from Ryan Lewis to get to this point.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how optimistic are you for future Macklemore's non-Ryan Lewis album?
I'm much more optimistic. I mean, if
that's not on a scale of 1 to 10.
I'm about to get there.
Okay.
You make the bold statement, and then you give the numbers.
All right.
Not all of us can be machines. Anyway, I would say if you asked me before this, if I knew that it was just business as usual, I would say that I'm like a 1 out of 10.
Oh, wow.
I'm not interested at all, right? I mean, I'll listen to it because Baby Fantasy Genius will demand that we listen to it. But all of these songs, he put out a song, I think, called, I don't even remember what it's called. There's a song about, it's called Dope Dealer, Drug Dealer, something like that. It's about, like, he does these songs. I mean, I hated so many songs on this Unruly Mess I Made. Where it's like, this is a song not just about like a personal story. It's about this grandiose thing, right? It's about prescription drugs. Like, you're just like batting so far outside of your element that it doesn't work at all. And so like the song Drug Dealer, it's just like, you're talking about the prescription drug industry. It's like, let's just take it back here for a second. Let's cool out for a second.
I mean, there's certainly a personal aspect to that discussion.
But even like the story, like he's got so far beyond the personal aspect, and like the personal aspect worked.
It's basically him trying to do his do same love for other things.
I listened to when this Unruly Mess I've Made came out. I went back and listened to the Versus EP, and he was able to tell personal stories about drug addiction that worked completely, right? It was what made him successful. It's what took him from being a local rapper to having some sort of national perspective, because these personal stories felt personal. And then he gets to This Unruly Mess I Made, and he's talking about, like, it's not just this personal thing. He's talking about somebody else, and then it expands, and then it expands, and all of a sudden he's trying to address the entire prescription drug industry. It's like, dude, okay. You know, like, bring it back here. And that's why that didn't work. And that's why the Versus EP did work, right? Because he's telling this personal story, and it feels like he's getting back to that.
Uh-huh.
So I think there is a difference. Anyway, so I would say that before this, I'm looking at like a 1 out of 10, like not interested at all.
Yep.
But now, after hearing this song, after understanding where he's at and the relationship, you know, maybe even stepping away from Ryan Lewis, if it meant that it took him to do this, I'm up to like a 7 or an 8.
Okay. When do we have a date for the album?
No, there's not even an album. This is just a song.
Okay. They did not announce an album.
No.
Okay.
This is called a single.
I'm familiar with the concept. I just thought that they were dropping that in promotion of a forthcoming album.
It's a single basically to announce that he's not working with Ryan Lewis anymore.
Uh-huh. Okay. It's just a breakup single.
It's a breakup single.
All right. Well, I'm curious to stay tuned and see where we go from here. Well,
can I say one last thing?
Yes.
Because I've thought this unruly mess I made review. The song Dance Off, featuring Idris Elba and Anderson .Paak, which I feel like people don't even realize. Like, that record has so much wasted talent on it throughout. It's like you have Anderson .Paak on a song who is right on the cusp of being one of the most sought-after young artists, and he's on the song for like 8 seconds and does nothing. And granted, Idris Elba singing the chorus to Dance Off is the best part of the entire record, but still, he could do even more. Look, Idris Elba can rap.
Okay.
It's just like, come on.
I think we awarded Anderson .Paak our 2016 Pulton Cast Album of the Year, right?
Did we?
That was our conclusion?
Not this album. Not that 8 seconds song.
Yes, no, not that one. His own album.
So we were talking about Malibu.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
I didn't realize we awarded albums of the year.
Yeah, no.
Are we not doing that?
Okay. Why not? Well, speaking of where we go from here.
We're going to Mark Elamore.
Yes.
I had to say it. No. You didn't want me to.
You didn't have to. No one forced you to do that. Me getting upset about a pun is so rare. We have a better idea of where Markelle Fultz is going.
Not a better, we know.
And that's Philadelphia.
Okay.
Where he went to work out over the weekend, and after that workout on Saturday, word came down that the Celtics and Sixers had finalized a trade, sending the number one pick in the draft from Boston to Philadelphia in exchange for the number three pick and a pick to come in the future, either the Lakers pick in 2018 or one from the Sixers or Kings. In 2019. So the Celtics pass on the opportunity to draft Fultz and pair him with Isaiah Thomas, and instead he will head to Philadelphia, where he will be part of the cornerstone of the process, whatever comes after the process, with Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons.
I guess if you can walk us through what this means for Markel, both on the court, what it means to play for Philadelphia versus Boston, and if it affects his potential future in any way.
Well, it definitely does that. I mean, from a short-term standpoint, he gets a lot more opportunity to play. If he had gone to Boston, he would have been part of a rotation, you know, probably at best Boston's fourth guard, depending, you know, if they had to trade Marcus Smart to clear cap space. But, you know, behind Smart, Avery Bradley, and Isaiah Thomas next season, assuming that none of those guys were traded. In Philadelphia, he probably starts at point guard from day one. And the Sixers clearly like his fit next to Ben Simmons because of the fact that, you know, they want Simmons to play point guard. Brett Brown has been very clear about, you know, him being in that role, which takes advantage of his skills. He's someone who really needs the ball in his hands. But they think Fultz can be effective playing off the ball in addition to, you know, also running the offense when Simmons is on the bench. You'll probably see those two guys work together at times, with Simmons as the screener, sort of like a, you know, Draymond Green in the Warriors offense, where, you know, if you double team Fultz, if you trap him off the pick and roll and he gets it to Ben Simmons, then that's a huge advantage for the Philadelphia offense. And then also I think we'll see some of what Portland does in terms of you run a pick and roll with Damian Lillard on one side of the court, get the defense to overload to that side, the way the defenses generally defend the pick and roll now, and then you swing it to the other side, and Markel runs a pick and roll with your other big man, and suddenly that backside help is cleared out. So those are all things I think we're looking at with Markel in Philadelphia.
Interesting. What would Markel have been in Boston? He's basically not getting that many minutes. He's the number one pick, but is kind of buried.
Next season. And I mean, certainly if he would have played well, that could have changed things. But, you know, he would not have gone into the year expecting to play a lot of minutes. In Philadelphia, he will. I mean, you know, in Boston, a couple years down the road, they might have oriented their entire offense around him. And I think, you know, had Isaiah Thomas moved on, that there was probably more offensive upside for Fultz in Boston than there is in Philadelphia, which is why I'm a tiny bit disappointed is like a Markelle Fultz fan that he's going to Philadelphia. Because, like, he can play with Simmons, but it's not going to maximize his skills playing with Simmons.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you considered the perspective of, I felt uncomfortable with having to cheer for the Celtics that much?
I mean, no, because first off, you should have already been cheering for the Celtics that much because of Isaiah Thomas.
I would have pushed it over the top with Markelle too. I mean, it would have meant that they would have had to be our team.
Yes, oh, without question.
Now we can divide our allegiances a little bit. Look, I've been hating the Celtics for a long time.
Have you?
Sure.
Were you?
Since the 80s.
Yeah, you were really invested in that? How old do you think you were when the last Lakers-Celtics finals occurred?
I don't know, 3 maybe?
You were 2.
2.
And you probably turned 2 during the series.
But I knew that I'm a Lakers person. I'm not a Celtics person.
Yes.
And
that
also
was a long time ago.
Boston fans.
They love Isaiah Thomas. Almost as much as Seattle fans.
All right, I'll give them that. What do you expect from Markelle Fultz overall, though? What do you expect him to be next year?
Next year? I mean, I think there's a pretty good chance he's not very efficient next year. You know, one of the concerns that I do have about him in the NBA is he didn't finish at a high percentage around the rim last season. Probably won't shoot a high percentage from the NBA three-point line right away. So that combination to me suggests he might be really inefficient. You know, in my projections of the guys who are likely to go in the top 10 in the draft, lowest projected true shooting percentage of any of them
really?
Is a rookie.
Really?
Yeah.
Any of them?
Yeah.
Aren't there some players in there who can't shoot at all?
Yeah, De'Aaron Fox. I mean, part of that is because of the fact that three-point percentage gets regressed pretty heavily to the mean in those projections. So, you know, maybe De'Aaron Fox is even worse than I'm projecting. But his efficiency right away is pretty low.
Okay. Can we undo some of the things that you've done on other podcasts by comparing Markelle Fultz to Jordan Farmar?
Look, I don't like to use similarity scores, and I may throw them out entirely because it's just being misinterpreted.
People love similarity scores, though.
They do. They just don't work with college prospects. There's not a big enough pool.
But I guess to undo that, let's look at Markelle Fultz 5 years from now. What does he look like?
I mean, I think there's a pretty good chance he's an all-star. You know, I think probably one of the better pick-and-roll players in the league at that point. A lot will depend on how far his three-point shot goes. You know, if he shoots something in the NBA like the 40% he shot from three-point at UW from the shorter college line, he's going to be an elite point guard, no doubt about it. I'm skeptical that he's going to do that because, you know, his free throw percentage was much, much lower, and that's actually historically been a slightly better predictor of three-point percentage in the NBA than the college three-point percentage you shoot, which I feel like I've said on about 20 podcasts so far.
Yeah. It makes me nervous, though. Every time Markelle shot a three, I didn't think to myself, that's going in.
It's interesting because, I mean, on the one hand, he shoots a really easy three-point shot, but it also seemed like it was going to be short every single time because of that. I don't know if you had that feeling.
The finishing at the rim that you were talking about, it's like, I feel like his shooting will be much worse than it was in college, but I feel like he'll eventually be able to finish much better.
And I mean, the upside for him is I may not be factoring into my projections enough the fact that there was so little space in the UW offense most of the time with two traditional big men. And
so he's not going to be playing with Carlos Johnson next year?
I don't anticipate that, as he is not eligible for the draft.
But Sam Timmons.
I mean, I feel bad because, you know, Kevin O'Connor from The Ringer has pointed out repeatedly that he was in, like, Lorenzo Romar's archaic offense. And it's like no, just look at 2 years ago. Marquise Chris was shooting threes.
It's just an archaic defense.
It is an archaic defense. But they just didn't have the personnel last year. Like, when they tried to go small, it meant they were playing, you know, Dominic Green and Carlos Johnson.
No, the offense was, it was a fast offense that shot a lot of threes.
Two years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a good offense 2 years ago because they were playing a big man who could shoot, and then they had a lot of perimeter depth so that they could easily go small. So it made more sense then. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing you really take, you know, if you believe that Fultz is going to be a star, that's one of the big things you believe, is that he'll have more floor spacing in the NBA than he did in college.
They're really believing on a lot of players in Philadelphia to do more than they did in college.
Well, I mean, first off, most freshmen are going, if they're like that good freshmen, they're going to do more in the NBA.
But it makes me a little bit nervous seeing both Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz, who are on teams that came, that did not make the NCAA tournament as freshmen.
It doesn't worry me.
Okay. Are we cheering for the Sixers?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm cheering for the Sixers.
I mean, the Sixers.
I was already cheering for the Sixers.
Sixers fans taking a victory lap about the Markelle Fultz trade is not making it easy to root for the Sixers right now, but. You know. You
have to give them something.
I look, if they're excited, that's one thing. If they're, again, saying how wrong everyone else was.
Retweet Armageddon's.
Yeah.
That's a bit premature. Wait until they've won a game.
Like, I don't really believe in karma, but you know how Bill Simmons felt about Joe Lacob's interview and the light years ahead comment before the Warriors had won the championship that year? That's a little bit how I feel about this.
Are you nervous?
Like, especially, you know, Ben, guys, Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons still are injured.
I know. The chances of Markelle Fultz missing his first entire season seem pretty high.
Ben Simmons has never played a game in the NBA.
Are you nervous at all about Markelle Fultz's injury history?
I'm putting my fingers, like, almost together, but not quite together.
There's a little bit of concern, though. It's not zero.
Yeah, the fact that he had to be held out of, you know, training camp last year, preseason practice, because of the fact that his workload in the summer had been a concern, is a bit of an issue. But I mean, it's not uncommon at this point for 19-year-olds to come into the league having kind of been overworked by their youth basketball schedule. I don't think that's unique to him.
Okay. So Markelle is going to go number one.
Yes.
What about any other Northwest players who are in the draft?
So it's a relatively light year in that regard. We have no Seattle guys in the draft year this year. Nigel Williams-Goss, the UW transfer, who then reached the national title game last year with Gonzaga.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. He declared for the draft, I think is likely to go undrafted, which made it interesting. So this year, for the first time, Vegas is allowing people to gamble on draft props. And so I don't know if this is an official, like this actually matches the line, but you can bet on Nigel Williams-Goss.
You're gonna have to go ahead and send me that link. I'm going to want to look at that.
He's a plus 120 to go undrafted.
Okay.
So that means you make more than your money back if he goes undrafted. It seems exceedingly unlikely to me that he gets drafted. Unless like someone has inside information that he's agreed to go play for someone's D-League team, which is actually what determines if he gets drafted in the second round. Let me look where he is on Chad Ford's big board. 74. They only draft 60 guys. So I don't know. Maybe Vegas knows something we don't. They often do. That's why those casinos are so big and fancy. But that struck me as exceedingly
interesting.
Also, why is there a prop on Nigel Williams-Goss getting drafted?
I love the Nigel Williams-Goss prop.
I guess maybe because he like played high school ball in Vegas.
Oh.
I it's a bit of a mystery.
There's not a prop on like every single second round player?
No.
Very few of them?
You can bet on how many Oregon players will get drafted. There's a line of 2.5 on that between Jordan Bell and Dylan Brooks and Tyler Dorsey.
What are you taking in that one?
I'd probably take over, I guess.
Tell me more about these props. I want to go through these, what you're taking.
You really are excited about this.
These are the best.
All right, hold on. Let me pull up this link.
You're going over on the 2.5 Oregon players getting drafted?
Yeah, I think all three of those guys will probably get drafted.
I mean, the second round of the NBA draft is such a crapshoot, right? I mean, I remember watching the year that there we go. Zing. That's a ding. Watching the year that Isaiah Thomas was the last pick in the draft, it felt like it was just European after European after European. And yeah. Is that still the case with the second round?
A little bit less because now that, especially this year, I mean, we sort of don't know how it's going to work this year because this is the first year that teams can sign. If you waive your second round pick, you're the only person that can sign them to the two-way contract that the league is putting in this year.
What are you talking about? If you waive your second round pick?
Yes.
Just don't draft somebody.
No. If you draft them and cut them.
Okay.
So, like, before you could draft them and cut them, and then you would have the first rights to sign them in the D-League, but anyone could also then, like, they could like just go somewhere else, basically. They could go play overseas.
Okay.
Now they've made it so you have basically exclusive rights to them if they want to take this two-way contract, which pays you slightly more money in the D-League. And then when you are in the NBA, which is limited to a certain number of days, it pays you like an NBA player when you are in the NBA. So it's a better deal for the player than it was initially.
Well, that's good.
So I don't know. There's a lot of over-unders on draft position.
Is there a Markelle Fultz prop, or is it just a given that he's number one?
I am not sure if there is a Markelle Fultz prop.
I'm just shocked there isn't Nigel Williams-Gotts one.
It's quite baffling. Okay, but the more interesting
also, should we talk about this now? About how amazing it is that the Huskies are going to have the number one pick in the NBA and WNBA drafts?
Yeah, we should talk about that. Yeah.
I know that you have your tweet queued up for it, right?
I mean, at this point, it kind of feels like it's been done. It was more notable when Kelsey Plumlee.
You have to post it. All you right. have to be like Darren Rovell at the Super Bowl, just waiting to tweet about Gatorade or whatever. You have all your tweets written and ready to post. You have an intern to post them.
I did that during the draft lottery because I had to do analysis for the draft lottery. And it was basically like the same kind of fun facts that Mark Jones reads on the air.
You actually wrote your tweets beforehand?
Yeah.
And had an intern post them?
No, I didn't have an intern post them.
Anyway, it's pretty amazing, right?
Yeah, it's very cool. Especially, I mean, the fact that Markelle Fultz was at the WNBA draft. Kelsey Plum presumably will not be able to attend the NBA draft because the Stars are playing Wednesday and
she's
Friday.
She's already been released from the WNBA.
Oh, easy here. We're going to get to that later. I don't know what else there is to say about it. It's very cool.
It's very cool. It would have been really nice if we had the number one pick next year.
Yeah, that would have been great. Number of Kentucky players drafted in round one, over under 2.5.
And what are you taking there?
I think that's +500 on the, or -500 on the over, +330 on the under.
So basically guaranteed that there will be three Kentucky players.
Yeah, it's pretty likely. So De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk are certainties, and Bam Adebayo much more likely to go in the first round than not.
This is the first year that they're doing NBA draft props in the same way that this is the first year that Vegas was doing NFL draft props.
Yes, same thing. Number of seniors selected in round one, the line is 1.5.
Oh my God.
Wow, that's actually kind of crazy.
1.5?
I think I might take the over there. Yeah, that's a tough call.
Wow, times have really changed.
I'm doing like my version of where I draft every player, and I think I definitely have at least two. Josh Hart and Alec Peters. So look out for that on ESPN Insider. Check that bingo square of Kevin promotes in the ESPN Insider article. Number of UCLA players drafted in round one, line of 2.5, -500 on the over. I would be very surprised if it was not 2.5.
Who are these players?
Well, Lonzo Ball.
Okay, heard of him.
He's going to go number two to the Lakers.
Uh-huh. And then Bryce Halvard's the only other UCLA player I know, so I'm assuming it's him, right?
Yeah, no. TJ Leaf, who will go somewhere in the teens. And then Ike Onigbogu, who is like a freshman center who barely played for them, but is very promising in terms of potential. He'll probably also go somewhere in the teens, maybe early 20s. Number of North Carolina players drafted in round one, line of 1.5. So that... Justin Jackson is the sure thing there. I don't know who the other one is they're looking at going in the first round. Kennedy Meeks, I guess?
Okay. Well, anyway, aside from this, are there any other Northwest players who'll be involved in the draft? No other Huskies.
Yeah. I don't expect that Malik Dime will be taken. No, there's one other really interesting player from the state of Washington, and that's Jacob Wiley, who played at Eastern Washington, and is a guy who only had 1 year of eligibility there, bounced around from some JCs, and you know finally got a chance to really play Division I basketball last year at the age of 22, and only had the 1 year of eligibility, but showed enough potential as kind of a versatile 3-4 defender that he could go in the second round. And he was someone that I did have drafted in my version of the mock draft.
Can we talk from the Portland perspective really quick also? Does Portland have a first-round pick this year?
They have three of them.
Wow.
Their over-under is 2.5, and they get the over. So they have their own pick, which will be 15th. the first of the non-lottery selections. And then they have the Memphis Grizzlies pick at 20th and the Cleveland Cavaliers pick at 26th.
Wow, they managed to accrue a lot of bad first-round picks.
They did, a spectacular number.
In the same way that they accrued a lot of bad contracts last summer.
Well, they may trade one or more of these picks to get rid of some of those bad contracts. I wouldn't be stunned to see that. So I had them going for Isaiah Hartenstein, whose father played at Oregon. He's an international player playing in Lithuania with Žalgiris, but played well at the Nike Hoop Summit.
Okay. I was going to say one of the best Jewish players to come into the NBA in a long time.
No, sadly no. I had Anik Bogo going to them with the 20th pick. And then with the 26th pick, I had them taking a draft and stash Alexander Vezenkov, who plays for FC Barcelona. He's scored several goals.
I like that joke way too much.
Yeah, you did.
If they were to trade some of these picks with players, what do you think that would look like? Who are the players that they're looking to dump? Can they get rid of Evan Turner?
Maybe, but probably not. I mean, realistically, I don't think they're probably actually going to do that. Myers Leonard's contract would maybe be the most movable at only $10 million a year. So,
what are their worst contracts? All of them tied?
I mean, Evan Turner still has 3 years left, and I believe about $53 million, 53, 54 left on that one.
We're Sixers fans anyway. Who cares?
And then Alan Crabb, I mean, his contract isn't terrible. He's making a little more than $18.5 million a year.
Are you kidding me?
But then he also has a 15% trade kicker, so if you're trying to trade him, all of a sudden he's making over $20 million a year.
Oh, man.
And that's a real problem.
If players from the olden times should focus a lot more energy on how much current role players get paid instead of complaining about how they could have beaten the Warriors, they should focus a lot more on Alan Crabb getting paid $18 million a year.
Oh, I think they found time for that one, too. The one thing to watch for the Blazers, so Festus Ezeli, who never played for them all year because he was injured the entire season,
yes,
has $1 million guaranteed on his 2017-18 salary.
Really?
Through June 30th. So the Blazers basically need to trade him before then so that they can take that completely off there. They can pay someone else $1 million to just take that. Then they don't have to stretch it, and then it would go on their luxury tax. So they will come out ahead if they just pay someone to be rid of that contract.
What is his contract otherwise?
Well, what is his full salary? $7.7 million.
Okay.
There is zero chance of them taking that salary.
Okay. Festus Ezeli will have come to Portland, earn a paycheck, and then leave Portland.
I mean, it's happened before with Blazers centers. It's happened before.
So you think, I mean, best case scenario, they're not getting out of their salary cap hell.
No, and I don't know how motivated they really are to do that.
They're fine with where they're at?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I just, you know, Paul Allen is willing to pay it, is my sense.
I mean this more from less from a willing to pay it perspective and more from a actually fielding a playoff caliber team perspective.
Well, I mean, unless they trade for Paul George, I don't know that they're really changing things dramatically in that
regard.
There's
just nothing they can do.
No, I mean, a full year of healthy use of Nurkic is the biggest thing they can do.
Okay. They already got their first round pick.
And they got three of them.
Also have three.
Because they got one of those in that trade with Yusuf Nurkic. It was a really good trade. Basically made Neil Olshay's entire year.
Is there a chance that they trade any of these picks for future first-round picks?
Yeah, that's conceivable.
Okay.
There's so little value
to having three kind of late first-round picks.
No, I don't agree with that at all.
You don't agree with that at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's what allows you to trade Ed Davis to get out of his contract, where, you know, he's perfectly fairly paid, but if you trade him, you're saving like $9 million because of the fact that, or more than that, because of the fact that you're paying 150% of his salary in luxury taxes. So okay. that's, again, the other trade they might make is Ed Davis.
Okay. So they could attach a first-round pick to Ed Davis.
No, I don't think you'd need to. Like, Ed Davis is fairly paid.
So the first-round pick allows them because they can draft somebody else?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You're getting a little bit upset here at Blazer stuff. Anyway, any other thoughts on the draft?
I think we've covered sufficiently.
More than sufficiently?
Yes. As we push the hour mark already. Before getting into our Seattle sports roundup, we'll start here with Sonics Arena news. Not a relatively quiet week on that front. But the Soto Arena Chris Hansen Group did release, as promised, the letter from Goldman's or from JP Morgan.
I thought this happened last week.
Yeah, but it was after we recorded. JP Morgan detailing, you know, their interest in potentially financing the arena. Not a lot of specifics in that one, but, you know, showing just kind of matching the letter from Goldman Sachs that the Oakview Group had in relation to their financing of their project. They also, in relation to that, in the blog post, kind of laid out a plan of attack against the Oakview and Key Arena renovation plan, which is the three T's: transportation, timing, and taxes.
And what do you make of these three T's?
I mean, I think that's a good angle for them to take. It's interesting because of the fact that obviously transportation was such a controversial issue with the Soto Arena for a long period of time, given their location and proximity to the port. But if you compare it to Seattle Center and the traffic nightmare that is the Mercer Mess, suddenly it looks great, especially in terms of public transportation in the short term. Timing, you know, just being about the idea of not building until a team comes here and, you know,
being ready to build right now.
Yes. And the ability, how far along they are in the process where, you know, if they do get that team, they can start right away as opposed to...
They're the Philadelphia 76ers right now in the process.
Yeah.
And the other arena is the Philadelphia 76ers like 5 years ago.
Maybe the Hawks after they traded Dwight Howard. Maybe that's the comparison. And then the taxes, that's clearly the strongest argument here, is the idea that, you know, even though we're talking about the public asset of Key Arena, that, you know, the city is having to effectively forego a lot of tax revenue that they would be collecting at the Soto Arena if they approved the Key Arena site.
Okay.
So that's their case. We'll see how persuasive it is with Seattle City Council voters.
Yeah.
That's really all that matters. One other interesting note here on the arena front. I don't know if you noticed this. So the Clippers reportedly in talks with the city of Inglewood to build a new arena.
Which I've heard is always up to no good.
I have also heard that. They want to get out of the Staples Center where they are the third tenant behind the Lakers and the LA Kings there and really get the worst of the dates on that one. So this is interesting because of the fact that also in Inglewood is the Forum, former home of the Lakers for many, many years, including during the 80s when you were such a big fan of them.
God, love that team.
For the crib, you were cheering on Kurt Rambis. Go big game, James. So now it has been converted to a music venue, which is owned by Madison Square Garden and run by Oakview, the same group that's seeking to renovate Key Arena. And they are not real happy about the idea of this, of a new NBA arena in Inglewood.
Okay.
And have threatened to sue the city over it.
Sue the city of Inglewood?
I believe so, yeah.
Do they have an exclusivity clause?
They do not.
They're just going to sue?
I think their concern was over the use of eminent domain in the... you know, of the land for this arena, which the mayor argued that they have not decided to do yet.
Okay. He argued that Steve Ballmer is richer than
I mean, that's a tough competition, but yeah, I guess he wins. So there you go. We'll see if we hear anything more on the arena front next week. I think, though, as we push the hour mark, it is time to get to your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
I understand they may have been playing well for a couple days here.
Uh-huh.
But I was doing some reflecting this weekend.
That's usually a part of hot takes.
And to me, the worst thing about this Mariners team is not just this season. It is that the Seattle Mariners have ruined baseball in Seattle for an entire generation. Over the last 15 seasons, going back and forth, good and bad, mostly bad.
Wait. Average and bad.
Going almost making the playoffs and bad. Over this generation, there are people that have never seen good baseball and have determined they do not care about baseball in the first place, including us. Here is a list of things.
Although we were actually turned off by the team playing too good.
Yeah, I was turned off.
Not by
turned off by them being good. Okay, do you want to hear a list of things that I would rather watch than watch a Mariners game?
Oh, no. I mean, yes, obviously, yes. I want to hear that.
The Confederations Cup.
Okay.
NASCAR.
Really?
Canadian football, which is on a lot right now.
Is it?
That clip of the ferry crash from Grey's Anatomy?
Haven't seen that one.
College basketball!
Oh, wow. Why do we even watch college basketball?
But I've come to a conclusion. I understand what will turn around this team's future, and that is three words.
Okay, is it transportation, timing, and taxes?
Sam fucking Hinkie!
Oh, what?
That's right!
You're advocating the process for the man. He is going to be a hot commodity! Yeah. People see that Markelle Fultz plays well, and they realize the process is real. They need to take the front office, turn it over completely, turn it to Sam Hinkie and his spreadsheets and his manifesto. That's right.
So this is sort of like the Browns bringing in Paul DePodesta to run their football
Even
operation?
Even better. Better than that. He is tearing it down.
Can you do that in baseball? But the Astros proved you can do
top
that
to bottom. He's tearing it down way more than the Astros did.
How many games are the Astros up in the AL West? Like 35?
100 games. They're going to break the Mariners' record of regular season wins this year. Just to spite them. Just to show them that Sam Hinkie should be the GM. And so the people of Seattle, they'll be fine with him not engaging with the public. Honestly, if we made plans with Sam Hinkie, we would break them anyway.
Wait, what?
He would fit right in.
Is this part of the Seattle thaw?
Yeah, the Seattle freeze. It's the exact opposite. There's no Seattle thaw. This right now is the time to turn over the organization and start the process.
Wow. So I was wondering how you were going to come up with hot takes this week, because of the fact that, you know, the Mariners going pretty much 500 all the time. You know, it seems antithetical to hot takes, but you found them, good sir. You dug deep underground under the Seattle freeze and you found those hot takes.
The Seattle thaw.
Do we want to talk about the actual Mariners?
That's the actual Mariners.
The process is the actual Mariners. I don't think it is quite yet.
I would actually rather watch college basketball.
You weren't lying about that?
No.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, it's been a while since you've watched college basketball, so you know, I think if you actually did it, like, but around like the 10th foul call in the 3 minute span, then you'd be crying out for some Mariners baseball
for some 3.5 hour games.
Felix
for
Hernandez,
a pitching change.
Felix Hernandez returning to the rotation on Friday, making his triumphant return.
Sadly, that's going to work out well.
Sadly, Hisashi Iwakuma will not be following him on Saturday, as was originally planned.
Hot take, he might retire before he ever pitches again for the Mariners.
After a disastrous two-inning rehab start in Tacoma on Monday, he will be making at least one more rehab start before returning to the Mariners, or perhaps retiring.
Look, I don't know if anybody out there plays out-of-the-park baseball. This might be a little bit esoteric, but every once in a while you'll have a pitcher as they age and they might go from like 3.5 stars and they'll just, their career will crater, right? And they'll be like a half star pitcher and they won't be able to get anybody out. And that's what happened to Hisashi Iwakuma.
Oh, wow.
Like out of the park baseball is real.
That's, we're all in a simulation. John Segura also started his rehab Monday in Tacoma and appears close to returning. We'll see exactly how long that takes, but, good to know that he'll be back soon, sporting that fresh contract extension.
We're on our knees praying to God. On our knees praying to God, too.
Playing to the OTP gods, apparently. All right, enough on the Mariners, apparently. Well, let's go to the Seattle Sounders, who, in a familiar story, had some good moments at NYCFC, but still lost 2-1 after taking an early lead on a Christian Roldan goal. They saw David Villa score a pair of goals, including a controversial penalty where Jovan Jones was called for what looked like pretty minimal contact in the box.
Terrible call.
It was a tough call. At the same time, you look at the expected goals, 2-1 was about the fair result from this game. NYCFC did kind of control possession for most of it and had the better chances.
Kind of a strange game all around.
Well, it was played in a freaking downpour.
Played in a downpour, and also the small pitch that NYCFC plays on kind of meant that the play itself was a little bit strange, but we saw it early on. I mean, the Sounders were lucky to take that 1-0 lead, but we could see that NYCFC was a much stronger team out there.
Yeah. So Sounders, with three matches in a nine-day span, will be back in action Wednesday night hosting Orlando City SC.
Who also are playing well, right?
They are. Although their advanced stats, not that impressive. They have the fifth worst defense in MLS, according to Soccer Power Index. And their offense weakened in this matchup because they will be without striker Kyle Lahren, who has 8 goals this season but is suspended indefinitely after his arrest for DUI early Thursday morning in Orlando when police found him driving the wrong way on the roadway. So the Orlando City did manage to score 3 goals without him in a 3-3 draw at home against Montreal on Saturday, but also could be without Kaká, their designated player and aging star in this one. You know, he is part of squad rotation. They're also playing 3 matches in 8 days, and he has tended not necessarily to play a lot on turf. So some thinking that he might be, you know, played the second half only in this one. Probably not going to get a full 90 out of Kaká.
Okay.
So I think a pretty good chance for the Sounders to get three points from this one at home. And then on Sunday, they travel down I-5 to take on the hated rival Portland Timbers. And not a lot, I feels like, to say about the Timbers, except that basically every time the Sounders play in Portland, they lose in ugly fashion.
This is a very interesting week. I mean, with these three matches, a lot could happen. Right? I mean, they could end up with 0 points in these 3 matches.
That's not inconceivable.
Right now, it feels like, I mean, granted, look, the MLS season is long.
Is it?
There's a lot of time to go. But at the same time, when you play 3 matches within 8 days, they start to matter at that point. And if they don't pick up at least 2 points here, I mean, it just, the farther we get along, it feels like it's becoming more and more of an issue.
So you're saying it gets late early in the MLS season?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, we looked at this a year ago, and the Sounders were out of the playoffs. Their manager was... when was Ziggy Schmitz fired?
Definitely way after this.
Things can turn around late also, because the season goes on forever. So it's never too late. But, and you know, we haven't even reached the summer transfer period.
But if you look at the 538 Soccer Power Index projections, Sounders about 50-50 at this point to make the playoffs.
And that's why I'm saying this could be a crucial weekend with playing these 3 matches. And, you know, there are a lot of teams that are kind of in their same range. 2 on the road. I think if they don't pick up 2 points, it would be a disappointing outcome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would say anything below 3 would be a little bit disappointing.
But, I mean, watching them in New York, it looked like... And again, things can change quickly because we watched them almost a year ago, right? If we can go in Time Machine, get into our George Michael sports machine. I think he had a Time Machine too.
Fujikao.
1 year ago, we watched them play NYCFC at home, and their striker at that time was Jovan Jones. Right?
Dempsey was playing with the national team at that point.
I don't know where Jordan Morris was.
Well, right? Morris was probably playing with the national team.
Dempsey was gone for whatever reason.
Because last year would have been during the middle of the Copa America Centenario.
Jovan Jones was the only attacking option at that point. And they played that game against NYCFC and just a miserable loss, right? Yep. It looked like we saw that.
Like most of the times we went last season until the playoffs.
So we had some nice games at the end. But we went to that game and said to ourselves, this team is not a team that's going to make the playoffs. They looked like they had no depth. They looked like they couldn't score. They're playing a defender as their only striker. I mean, this was before Ladero was here. And then in the end, they looked like the best club in the league. So,
well, no. They looked good enough to scratch out a scoreless draw at Toronto and win it. Let's remain calm. We were not the best team on the pitch that day. There was no doubt about it.
You know, if it would have been played here, it might have been a different outcome.
It might have been a different outcome. It had been like negative 20 degrees.
Look, the outcome was fine, actually. I did take that back. We wouldn't have wanted a different outcome because the Sounders won.
Yes.
But we're cheersing that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. But a lot, basically what I'm saying is a lot can change. And really, we're back to the same point playing the exact same team, and it feels almost exactly the same.
Well, there you go. There you go.
But in the time in between, the Sounders won MLS Cup.
Yep.
So.
Okay. To that. All right. Seattle Storm were back home on Sunday, taking on the aforementioned Kelsey Plum in her return to Seattle with the San Antonio Stars. And it was another rough night for Kelsey Plum.
Oh, no.
Shot 2 of 11 from the field. Had her shot spectacularly rejected by Brianna Stewart. But she said afterwards, she did an interview with Elise Woodward on the court, as many of the fans who were in attendance, specifically to see Plum wearing UW gear, stuck around for that. She said it was kind of symbolic of her entire rookie season, that block, because she thought she had that layup, and then Stewart came out of nowhere.
Wow.
And rejected her.
I did not realize there was such a difference.
Stewie had a great game in this one. 22 points, 15 rebounds, 5 blocks, was knocking down the pick-and-pop 3, had 3 three-pointers in this one, and Storm win going away 75-57 is the Stars' fall to 0-11 so far in this season.
Oh, no. So Brianna Stewart was the first pick a year ago, right?
Yes.
And how has she adjusted to the WNBA?
Oh, she was one of the 5 best players in the league as a rookie. I mean, now...
It's not, I'm sorry, Kelsey First Plum. Off. It's not, First it off. Doesn't look good.
First off, like, Brianna Stewart is like, Kelsey Plum was like a number one pick. Brianna Stewart is like a generational talent. Like,
okay.
Like, she won 4 national championships in 4 years.
But a lot of people did. A lot of players won 4 national championships in 4 years.
We literally talked about this with Sue Bird, which, by the way, I forgot I was supposed to say. Former Pelton Cast guest, Sue Bird, was the representative athlete ally. No one else has done that. She was the first. Okay. Her and her class, including Mariah Jefferson.
There are other people in her class, is Kelsey Plum.
Yeah, no. But
look, that would have happened to if they wouldn't have lost one game this year. Hmm? Okay, you're saying it was because of her.
That they won 4 national championships in a row, that they had never done that even when they had Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi? Yeah, I'm giving her the credit for that.
Okay.
Anyways, she is an exceptional, like, she's going to be one of the greatest players in WNBA history, without a doubt. And she looked like it on Sunday and was the main reason the Storm.
How would you compare Kelsey Plum to D'Angelo Russell?
D'Angelo Russell was a little more efficient early on. I mean, but I was going to say the other thing is Kelsey Plum had...
worse than D'Angelo Russell?
I'm still on D'Angelo Russell. What did we set on?
Inlet?
I don't know. she had the high ankle sprain coming out of training camp, and that definitely set her back a little bit. It didn't seem like she was moving poorly necessarily in this game. She wasn't beating people off the dribble. So we'll see if she can do that when she gets to full health. But as for the Storm, they move on this week to host the Phoenix Mercury on Pride tip-off night. And the new all-time leading scorer in the history of the WNBA, Diana Taurasi.
Oh, but she doesn't have 4 championships in a row.
She doesn't. She got nothing.
I think she has something.
I think she only won 3 national championships.
Shame.
I believe they didn't win her freshman year.
And what about UW sports?
So an interesting note here. Husky softball getting a transfer. Taryn Attlee transferring to UW from Rutgers. She's a Sacramento native who played 1 year there, has 3 years of eligibility. Figures to be eligible immediately, which is good because she can help as a middle infielder replace departed senior All Pac-12 shortstop Ali Aguilar. Is a freshman, Attlee hit .393 with a .443 on base percentage and a .500 slugging percentage. So that's a pretty nice pickup to have there.
Yeah. I mean, I would compare her favorably to Russell Wilson transferring from NC State to Wisconsin.
I mean, he only had 1 year of eligibility, so it's not even close. So I look forward to remembering this next spring and being happy about it. To close out here, the Seahawks. And it wrapped up their OTAs last week and kind of head into their break before training camp starts in about a month here, right? It's coming. It is coming. The notable roster things I think that we saw last week, Jeremy Lane playing primarily on the outside, although then also shifting inside to nickel with Shaquille Griffin taking over on the outside. That basically the base formation for the Seahawks at this point. And in fact, the reports from OTAs indicated they basically never played anybody at weak side linebacker. We have no idea how that competition is going.
So Jeremy Lane was playing outside, except for never.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't totally follow that. It's a fair point. The other note on
Jeremy Lane playing outside, except it didn't ever happen.
The other note that we saw was that Bradley McDougald playing a variety of different roles in the Seahawks secondary, you know, as a big nickel, playing it that maybe at the weak slide linebacker spot if they, you know, effectively is a nickel in a nickel package.
I mean, he's somebody who, when you're looking at Shaquille Griffin being basically the starting cornerback on the right side, has a lot more experience than almost anybody else in the secondary.
Among cornerbacks?
Anybody in secondary.
I don't follow.
Well, anybody except for, you know, the
except for the three players with tons of experience?
Well, except for those three. I'm saying as far as anybody else, he's somebody who's coming in and has much more experience than somebody like Nyoko Thorpe or Shaquille Griffin.
Okay.
It's a big deal.
Also, did you see that Troy Maine Pope landed in Indianapolis?
Ugh.
To replace Robert Christian Michael?
No, Christian Michael, was he in Indianapolis too?
He was, and then he was injured, and they signed Tremaine Pope, and they still have Robert Turbin. So they are really just collecting former Seahawks running backs with the Colts. I, you know what? I respect what they're doing there.
Do you?
Tony McDaniel signed with the Saints. And then the last bit of Seahawks.
I would have guessed that he was on the Saints even when he was on the Seahawks. He's such a natural Saints player, isn't he?
I suppose. I don't know. Football Outsiders now has...
Kind of crazy that Tony McDaniel is still out there, though.
Yes, I agree with that, that he was unsigned at this point. Football Outsiders now has 3 decades worth of DVOA dating back to the 1987 NFL season, and they decided to celebrate with what they called 30 for 30, ranking the top 30 teams. Is that
trademarked by anybody?
They did it on ESPN Insider. It was okay.
Okay.
Ranking the top 30 offenses and defenses of the past 3 decades by DVOA.
And did any Seahawks offenses and defenses rank?
They did. So the 2005 Seahawks, of course, the team that played in the Super Bowl before it was canceled that year due to a shortage of referees, they ranked 17th on offense.
I thought that Super Bowl happened, but okay.
I can't ever remember. Yeah, it's tough to tell. The 2013 Seahawks, who did play in the Super Bowl, defeated the Denver Broncos in that Super Bowl. Yes. Ranked 8th on defense, and that low only because of the fact that they played one of the easiest schedules of opposing offenses in the NFL that season, which is weird because they did play one of the best offenses in NFL history in the Super Bowl and held them to 8 points.
That was just one game, though. Come on.
Still. I mean, I'm not complaining. Like, what am I really going to complain? They're underrated vis-a-vis, you know, like, oh, the 1985 Bears were terrible.
They're not included in this.
All right, touche.
30 for 30.
Touche.
Who are the teams that finished ahead of them, though? Was it generally Ravens teams from the early 2000s?
I think there was one of those, and the Buccaneers were both in
there. The two championship teams.
I guess, yeah, there was only the one championship team for the Buccaneers. The 2015 Denver Broncos were one of the teams that were out of the Seahawks where, you know, that was their Super Bowl winning team. Where
They led that quarterback who was one of the best offenses of all time. Just 2 years later.
One of the worst. One of the, at least for a Super Bowl champion. All right, so number 7 was the 2008 Pittsburgh Steelers. Number 6, the 2008.
This is on ESPN Insider, so nobody has seen this.
6, the 2008 Baltimore Ravens. Number 5, the 2015 Broncos. Number 4, the 2004 Bills, who I believe didn't make the playoffs that year. Yeah, that was the year they lost to the Steelers when they weren't playing their starters in the final game of the season when they had a chance to make the playoffs. 3, the 2000 Baltimore Ravens. 2, the 2002 Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And number 1, the 1991 Philadelphia Eagles. So there you go.
Wow, really? 1991 Eagles?
Yeah.
And that was with Reggie White before free agency.
That is, yes.
But I feel like they never really get discussed as one of the best defenses of all time.
No, I mean, I think probably just because of the fact that the team wasn't very good because of the fact that Randall Cunningham tore his ACL in the season opener.
Well, I mean, I feel like having an offense and a defense in this list is still impressive.
Well, I mean, 32 franchises, so on average you'd probably expect about one of each in there, but... Yeah, not necessarily as high as 8th. That's good. So, all right, anything else this week? Wow, that was an exasperated sigh. That was a heavy sigh. You know, last week after we finished recording, I immediately turned to you and said, boy, that was a terrible podcast.
Were you talking about this?
Oh, yeah. And this week, I don't think it was.
Wow.
So I feel...
It's been Pelton Cast Reviews.
I feel...
we're going to review each podcast at the end.
I feel we made regression to the mean work for us this week.
Wow. Well, on that strange note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.